I was left a glass of water up here, but the glass is empty. Such service. But it's all right, because actually I'm going to include in my remarks this evening something about dinner, which shouldn't be too difficult for everyone to accept, because if you're like me, you're full. It's tomorrow night, it would be a problem. I first met Simon Wiesenthal in 1986. He was invited to speak at the University of California in San Diego, and the congregation I was affiliated with then, Congregation Bethel in La Jolla, co-sponsored the event with the university because of the Jewish nature of the program. My synagogue there had initiated a distinguished speaker series, of which that evening became a part. And over the years, the speaker series brought very well-known personalities to the synagogue podium. Coretta Scott King, Abba Iban, Alan Dershowitz twice, Norman Mailer before he died, Leon Uris, just naming a few. And as expected, each of them brought in very large crowds. For me, as the rabbi of that congregation, the series was a unique blessing, because it afforded me the opportunity to have dinner before the speaker spoke. Sometimes it was in a restaurant, and sometimes in my home, so that there were even opportunities for my children to meet some of these great personalities in a non-intimidating setting. Each and every guest was tremendously moving, and it was a great privilege to sit alongside them at the table with such notable personalities at the dinner that preceded our event. But meeting Simon Wiesenthal was the most moving experience of all. Wiesenthal was liberated by the Allies in 1945 from Mauthausen, the immense slave labor camp in Austria, which was designed to kill the intelligentsia who were collected from countries occupied by the Nazis by working them to death in munitions factories. I had always marveled at this man who, after his liberation, devoted his life to hunting down Nazis with the intention of bringing them to justice. The greatest crime of all had been committed against our people. While the wound could never be healed, salt was added to that wound continuously, with the realization that so many of the worst perpetrators were still living in freedom and even luxury in a variety of places throughout the world. Some were hidden in isolated retreats, immune from the outstretched arms of the law that tried to reach them. Others, like Eichmann, lived within society, with names changed and identities falsified. Many in South American countries like Panama and Argentina, or in European countries like Switzerland, neutral Switzerland, and Austria, and even in Germany. And we had our share in these United States as well. Simon Wiesenthal decided upon his liberation that he would not return to the profession he had just begun before the world war began. Instead, he assumed responsibility to track down Nazis and their cohorts and bring them to justice. He did that till nearly the day he died, shortly before his 97th birthday. And although he died in Vienna, where he had established a documentation center, Simon Wiesenthal is buried in Israel, on Har Herzl, because it turns out, and revealed much, much later, that he worked in constant partnership with the Mossad, Israel's secret service. I remember that dinner, the dinner where I sat next to Simon Wiesenthal. And I remember what he said from the lectern that night. He explained why he decided to hunt Nazis all his days. "I do it not because I think that by catching them and bringing them to justice, they will pay for their crimes. They could never pay for what they did. They killed thousands, millions," he said. "I do what I do because I want to prevent another Holocaust. And so if anyone in the future thinks that they can commit genocide and get away with it, they will realize that when the Nazis were defeated, they ran to hide all over the world, but there was someone who would not allow them to rest. There was someone who made them always look over their shoulders, who instilled in them a fear of being captured and being brought to justice. So I do what I do, hoping that the potential murderers of the future will realize that for them too, there will be someone just like me who will spend his every moment tracking them down, so that they too, if they continue with their deed, will never be able to rest. They too will spend all their days worrying if they are about to be caught and brought to justice. Wiesenthal's theme was justice, not revenge. And it became the title of one of his many books. The first book of Simon Wiesenthal I read is called Sails of Hope. And in it, Wiesenthal uses his skill as a private eye, as an investigator of people hiding their origins, to argue that Christopher Columbus was a Spanish Morano, not an Italian, who disguised his religious ties to Judaism as well as disguising his place of birth. Wiesenthal argued that it was no accident that Columbus set sail from Spain on the night after Tisha B'Av, the day of national mourning by the Jewish people, because that same day, Ferdinand and Isabella chose to see to it that no Jew be allowed to remain in Spain. In any case, whether Wiesenthal was correct or not about Columbus, he was a prolific author. His most famous work is called The Sunflower. It is a book he published in 1976 and has been reprinted in many languages and in many editions. In The Sunflower, Simon Wiesenthal deals with the central theme of Yom Kippur: forgiveness. It's not that he wrote about Yom Kippur. He wrote about forgiveness. And he starts off by telling a story. A story of an incident which occurred while he was on a forced labor work detail in the city of Lemberg. As slave laborers, they were forced to shovel garbage from trucks that brought in the refuse continuously and prepare the garbage for burning. He realized his work was a metaphor for his fate and that of the rest of the crew. They worked in the yard of a high school building that had been turned into a hospital by and for the Nazis. One day, Wiesenthal was suddenly pulled out of the line by a nurse and taken to a room where an SS officer lay dying of shrapnel wounds suffered at the Russian front. He was blind and weak and suffering in his last hours upon this earth. As soon as the nurse left the two men alone, following instructions given to her by the dying soldier, the Nazi officer confessed to Wiesenthal that he had participated in committing an atrocity, the murder of several hundred Jews in a town they occupied when the Russians fled the Ukraine. All those Jews, all women, children, and the elderly, were forced by bayonets into a house by this man and his comrades under orders of their commander. And then, with the doors closed, the house was set on fire, burning the occupants to death. As the fire raged, the SS soldiers surrounded it with rifles raised and were ordered to shoot anyone who tried to flee. An old man with a young boy and a woman, obviously the boy's mother, jumped out of a window from the third floor of the building. This SS officer then raised his rifle, as he was commanded to do, and shot them as they fell to their deaths. He explained to this anonymous Jewish prisoner, whom the nurse had randomly selected, that he realized soon after that he had committed a horrific act. And as he lay dying, he wanted to apologize to the Jews for his deeds and begs for forgiveness through this one prisoner. Wiesenthal is angry at having been asked to listen to this confession. And he keeps thinking that, well, to this one SS officer, it is a unique incident. What he saw and did has happened countless times in countless towns and villages and countless cities, and is still happening at that very moment, and will continue to happen until all the Jews are dead. And that after hearing the man's confession, Simon Wiesenthal knew that he too will be put to death soon by the same ruthless people who perpetrated the crime he had just listened to. The soldier's head was wrapped fully in bandages, bandages that covered his eyes as well as his face, and he could not see. When he finished his confession and asked for forgiveness repeatedly, Simon Wiesenthal got up from his chair alongside the man's bed and without a word left the room in silence, without granting that Nazi his final wish. The next morning, the nurse told him that the young Nazi soldier was dead. Wiesenthal returned to his work group and later that night tells his comrades what had happened. He asks them if he was right in withholding absolution, or should he have accepted the man's remorse and forgiven him? Well, we find that their opinions differ somewhat, but by the time of liberation, none of Wiesenthal's comrades, not a single one of them men, are still alive. They were all shot or gassed or hung. Only he survived. Only he is alive when the Allies come. A man almost 6 feet tall, weighing less than 100 pounds. But in the years following, as he returns to society, Wiesenthal is plagued by his decision. Should he have forgiven that man or not? Over the next few years, Wiesenthal asks that question to people he meets whose opinions he respects, and again is given different answers. And so he publishes the question and those answers in his book, The Sunflower. When I read it the first time many years ago, the book had already become a text in the study of the Holocaust, because it helps people who are personally unconnected to the experience to feel a part of it. Over the years, Wiesenthal's book has been reprinted and translated, and each time new people are asked the question and added to the book, forgive or not? What I want to do with you tonight is to share three categories of the answers given to Simon Wiesenthal and see if we can learn something about the main theme of Yom Kippur, forgiveness. Because that theme is found on nearly every page of our Machzor and is the essence of our most profound prayers and poems included in this most holy of days. Every section of Al Chet concludes with the words V'al Kulam Elohas Lichot Slach Lanu Mechal Lanu Kaper Lanu. For all these sins we have enumerated, O God of forgiveness, forgive us, pardon us, grant us atonement. Every biblical quote in the Slichot sections of the service, one of which we have just chanted, includes references to God's mercy and compassion, the divine will to forgive. But what do we really know about forgiveness? How and for whom and when? The first category of answers is epitomized by the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama tells Simon Wiesenthal to forgive. To forgive even people who have committed atrocities against humanity. That was the right thing to do. The Dalai Lama doesn't believe that one should forget. Quite the contrary. Remembering, he says, is what can hopefully check the recurrence of such atrocities in the future. But he believes, forgive. Now the Dalai Lama is not talking stamm in der Welt rein. He's not talking in a vacuum. He points out that since the Chinese invasion of Tibet, more than 1.2 million Tibetans, one-fifth of their country's entire population, have lost their lives to massacre, execution, starvation, and suicide. But he tells Simon Wiesenthal a little story that explains his belief in the need to forgive. The Dalai Lama says, a few years back, a Tibetan monk who spent 18 years in a Chinese prison came to see me after his escape to India, because we knew each other before his arrest. During that meeting, I asked him what he felt was the biggest threat or danger he faced during those 18 years in prison. And I was amazed by his answer, says the Dalai Lama. It was extraordinary and inspiring. He said that what he feared most was losing his compassion for the Chinese. What was the Dalai Lama and all those who sided with that position of forgiveness, what were they trying to teach by relating such a story to Simon Wiesenthal? I believe their message is that harboring anger, resentment, wishes for revenge, all these feelings are detrimental to the purity of the soul of a human being. And that until one forgives, there is no redemption for the one who has been harmed. Forgiveness should be given to cleanse oneself even more than for the sake of the one appealing for it. And I can see the merit in his teaching. When we harbor hate or anger or resentment, it sits like poison in our hearts. Cleansing oneself of the poison can be achieved only if we exorcise it through the act of forgiveness. Perhaps that explains why God is ready to forgive us. Even though, as we sing in the final version of Avinu Malkeinu, we don't have sufficient merits that deserve your compassion. For the Dalai Lama, it's not a question of whether the perpetrators deserve forgiveness. It's a question of whether we want to continue living with and being contaminated by the poison of hate and anger in our hearts. Abraham Joshua Heschel was also asked Wiesenthal's question, and he took the opposite position from the Dalai Lama. Heschel was one of the great, truly religious men of the 20th century. Having escaped from Europe before the world began, he saw himself in exile as the Jews of Europe were being eradicated. He emerged from that experience with an incredible appreciation of life and the compulsion to cry out whenever human beings acted inhuman. And so he would often leave his classroom at the Jewish Logical Seminary time and again to march with Martin Luther King Jr. against racism in the United States, and then to speak out forcefully against the war in Vietnam. I was privileged to sit at the feet of Abraham Joshua Heschel, and just picturing his face in my mind when we were at the seminary, that alone fills me with inspiration and holiness. Heschel was truly a prophetic figure. So Abraham Joshua Heschel also responds to Wiesenthal with a story. But unlike the Dalai Lama, he never mentions either the Holocaust or any racial or ethnic persecution. And the sin in his story is nothing akin to the crime of the Nazi soldier. It's about a simple insult. But from this story, we learn a great lesson. His story is about the Rabbi of Brisk, who was a renowned scholar and a very gentle and pious man. Once, the rabbi boarded a train in Warsaw bound for his home city, Minsk, when several salesmen, Jewish men, entered his compartment. They had no idea who he was, as the Brisk Rav was a simple-looking, unassuming man and looked like any other ordinary bearded Jew. As the train pulled away from the station, the rabbi began to go inside himself, meditating and contemplating. The men, on the other hand, started playing cards. As the game went on, their excitement increased, and the rabbi's aloofness annoyed them. So one of the men suggested that he join them in the game. But the rabbi deferred, saying that he didn't play cards, and he was concentrating on his thoughts. This annoyed them even more. And a while later, they asked him again to play. And again he refused, preferring to remain deeply absorbed in his thoughts. But his aloofness, his refusal to join in what they enjoyed, bothered the men so much that one of them said, "If you don't play with us, we don't want you in this compartment." And with that, he grabbed the rabbi by the collar and yanked him out of his seat and pushed him into the narrow hallway outside the compartment. The rabbi of Brisk, the saintly sage, was then forced to stand for all the remaining hours of his trip home. When the train pulled into the station at Brisk, the rabbi got off, and so did the salesman who had pushed him out of the compartment. There were throngs of people waiting at the station to welcome their rabbi home. And when the salesman saw this, he asked, who is this man? "You don't know," was the response. "He's the famous Brisk Rav, one of the greatest scholars of our age." The salesman's heart sank. And immediately he approached the rabbi and asked for forgiveness, saying that he had no idea whom he had offended. The rabbi gave him a quick response. "No." Shocked and hurt, the man went to his hotel, but he had no peace. So he left and walked to the rabbi's house and was admitted to the study. There he said to the rabbi, "I am not a rich man, but I have 300 rubles which I would gladly give you to distribute as tzedakah in the community if only you would forgive me." But the rabbi's answer was curt again, a simple, brief no. The salesman walked to the synagogue seeking spiritual solace. There he found a few people there and he shared his sorrow. And when they heard the story, they were very surprised. How could our rabbi, who is such a gentle and pious man, withhold his forgiveness from this stranger? So they told him to go to the rabbi's eldest son. He will know how to approach his father, they said. Hoping to be rid of his guilt and shame, the man went and told his story to the son, who was equally surprised by his father's stubbornness and promised to discuss the matter with his father. But the son naturally had tremendous respect for his father. And according to Jewish law, it is not permitted for a son to criticize his father directly. So the son entered his father's study and began a general discussion about the laws of forgiveness. Finally, when the principles mentioned that a person who asked for forgiveness 3 times should be granted forgiveness, the son asked his father why he continued to refuse to forgive the man who had insulted him. The rabbi's answer was simple. "He didn't insult me. He didn't know who I was. He insulted someone that he assumed was a common man. So let him go to the common man and ask forgiveness from him. I can't forgive someone for something he did not do to me." Heschel continues, "No one can forgive crimes committed against other people. It is therefore preposterous to assume that anybody alive, including Simon Wiesenthal, can extend forgiveness for the suffering of even one of the 6 million people who perished. And then Heschel adds, according to Jewish tradition, even God himself can forgive only sins committed against God, not against man. So Heschel teaches us a different but equally important lesson from the Dalai Lama. That forgiveness can be granted only by those who have been hurt by the egregious act. That SS officer had shot and killed 3 people and participated in the murder of many more. But none of them was Simon Wiesenthal. And therefore, what right would Wiesenthal have to forgive that man? Jewish law insists that only the damaged person can grant forgiveness. And the ones hurt by this man are no longer alive. Therefore, the soldier must go down to his grave in remorse, but not forgiven. Perhaps in an afterlife, which he now believes in as a repentant Catholic, he can find those 3 people and the others from the burning house and ask them for forgiveness. But Wiesenthal has no right to forgive him. It would be meaningless. A third answer. That's the category of responses well stated by Deborah Lipstadt. She's a friend of mine who's become an authority on the complicity of free nations in the Nazi horror. And most recently, a ferret of neo-Nazis and academicians who deny the Holocaust entirely. In England, Deborah won a well-publicized case when a Holocaust denier tried to sue her for libel. And the case went far to discredit those bent on eradicating the truths about the Holocaust. Deborah Lipstadt turns to the halakha for her response. And although she cannot give a complete answer because there is too much about this particular SS officer she doesn't know, she implies that there is room to forgive such a man. She says that the decision needs to be based on the extent to which he is truly repentant. The Rambam, Maimonides, points out, Professor Lipstadt, lists a series of requirements for teshuva, for repentance. And in that list, he begins with the need for genuine remorse. One must confess one's sins, express shame and regret for having committed that sin, and resolve never to act that way again. Maimonides lists the laws of teshuva, much as the Karaite, whose words are read to you on the second day of Rosh Hashanah. And he goes on to say that when one finds himself in the same situation again, they must prove that they would act differently. And finally, teshuva, repentance, and forgiveness, as the Rambam, do not free the sinner from punishment. They must voluntarily subject themselves to the repercussions of their act and submit willingly to the price they must pay. In this situation, the SS officer did indeed deeply and profoundly regret his act. That's what made it so difficult for Wiesenthal, that his request for forgiveness was not perfunctory. The man explained to Wiesenthal that he grew up in a religious home and was a good boy in his youth. When he decided, like his school friends, to join the Hitler Youth, his parents were shocked and hurt. And his father, who was an opponent of Hitler, barely talked to him for the rest of his life. He also described the shock he felt when his unit was suddenly assigned to participate in the murder of the Jews about to be burned. And how ashamed it was later that he complied and followed the orders. He could live with fighting for his country, but not murdering innocent civilians. He told Wiesenthal that after the event, there were a number of soldiers who were sick over what they had done. And their commanders had to ply them with liquor to dull their senses and make them dismiss their consciences. But he, said the dying man, he could not dismiss what he had done. And wherever he went afterwards, he lived with regret and shame. The soldier was in his early 20s, and he knew he was about to die. All he asked for was absolution, forgiveness, so that he could go on into the next life cleansed of his sins. My friends, Tonight we begin this 24-hour fast designed to focus on our lives, how we've been living it, what regrets we have, what mistakes we've made, how we have hurt others and been hurt by others, how we need to make amends and do tshuva. We can learn from those three answers. They're not final answers, but they are valuable ones. From the first response of the Dalai Lama, let me say, he's right. If we, any of us, are harboring anger or hurt or resentment for what has been done to us in the past, we are hurting ourselves. We are harming our own spirits, and we are cheating ourselves of a deep inner peace. So I say, let it go. Whether they deserve it or not, let it go. Not for them, but for yourself. Forgive that brother-in-law, that parent, that sibling, that neighbor, that boss, that ex-spouse, that rabbi, that teacher, that bum, that no-goodnik. Forgive those who hurt you, or else they are still hurting you. Let it go. Slach lanu avinu ki chatanu, mechalanu malkeinu ki vashanu. Be what you want God to be, a forgiving being. And Heschel is also right. To be forgiven, one must go to the one harmed. It's not enough to ask God to let you off the hook for what you did to others. Only the ones you hurt can forgive you. Confessing your sins and your mistake to the bartender or the hairdresser may make you feel better for the moment, but the expiation does not last very long because it does nothing to make up for what you caused. If you have been the perpetrator of a hurtful act, don't think you can get away with anything until you've apologized to the one or ones you have hurt. Our tradition is so clear on this that it states that if one insulted or lied or bore false witness to someone in public, their apology must also be in public. They must gather the people who heard the insult and publicly acknowledge their wrongdoing. Apologizing in private is not enough. And Deborah Lipstadt is right too. There are times when it is no longer possible to approach those who've been wronged. They're gone, passed away, no longer in our world. One still needs to be filled with genuine remorse. And how is that demonstrated? By an honest confession, by a true commitment never to do that deed again. And one finds oneself in a similar situation to act differently than we did before. And finally, we must suffer the consequences of our action and not expect that contrition will absolve us from guilt. Apologies do not eradicate consequences. Yes, I met Simon Wiesenthal, and I consider it one of the great moments of my life. He taught me so much by the story of his life, and he showed me that one can devote themselves to a cause and thus give meaning to their lives. And so, I wish you all success in this Yom Kippur journey, for that's what it is, a journey. A journey into our souls, as well as into our deeds. May you emerge from this journey, by the time the shofar is blown tomorrow evening, with a commitment to forgive all others for your own sake. And a commitment to ask forgiveness from those you have harmed for your sake and theirs. And from a pledge to live differently in the year and years yet to come. Gemar Chatima Tova. May each and every one of us be sealed in the book of life. Amen.